there. I'm on the other line. That frees up my regular phone. So we won't be interrupted.
Council of Milwaukee Radio Broadcast, where the host is Dr. Janine James, Sister Ipua Ma'at, Sister Osati Anti, Brother Kwasi Craig, and Brother Quojo Robinson. The Sankofa Council of Milwaukee Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank Network, and it broadcasts on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Contact them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. Are you or is anyone you know suffering from the horrific effects of trauma? If so, the Little Book of Affirmations, Claim Your Narrative Over Trauma, can help you. This short ebook is a self-help tool to help you get started on the path of healing from the impacts of trauma. It is important to know that trauma is not an event. It is how your body responds to an event. School shootings, police shootings, the death of a loved one, car accident, all of these events can cause trauma in our bodies. But you can heal from it. I repeat, you can heal from it. So go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble to purchase your ebook today and just in time for the holidays, which is a time when a lot of people are suffering. Give the gift of healing for yourself or for someone you care about. The book was written by a licensed professional counselor who specializes in trauma-informed care. Follow her on Instagram at PLT_LPC and LinkedIn at Patricia Taylor. And I repeat, Instagram at PLT_LPC. And LinkedIn at Patricia Taylor.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. Open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today at 414-988-3079.
We'll pour to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, As we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Honorable Elijah Muhammad,
John Henry Clark, John
Dr. Khaled
Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Then I'd sing, 'cause I know
to be me. You'd see, you'd agree. Everybody should be free, cause if we ain't, we're murderous. Bitch, I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. It's moving now. I know, got news for you, I already know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me.
Listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee Radio Broadcast, where the host is Dr. Janine James, Sister Ipua Ma'at, Sister Osati Anti, Brother Kwasi Crabb, and Brother Kwojo Robinson. The Sankofa Council of Milwaukee Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank Network, and it broadcasts on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Contact them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com.
Habari Ghani, welcome, listening audience, to another enlightening show. And also welcome to our Sankofa Council in Milwaukee and the Sankofa Council of Elders. We have a wonderful show tonight. We have a guest coming from the left coast, California, Baba Ted Marsh, and we're going to be talking about elderhood. Elderhood is something that you don't hear a lot of discussion about, but we're looking at elderhood as a way of governing ourselves, going back to our ancestors. After 400 years of slavery, including acculturation, marginalization, and terror, people of African descent are ignorant of who we are and how we govern ourselves before slavery and before the plantation system. The governance structure of African people before 1619 was based upon an organized community. African people were governed by the wisdom of the elders, like indigenous people throughout the world. Now, our elders are warehoused in nursing homes where their wisdom is ignored and where they simply wait to die. Currently, our government is run by capitalistic interests and the police, formerly the slave patrol. The Sankofa Council of Milwaukee is looking back to reclaim our legacy of leadership and self-governance. So join us this evening to have a wonderful conversation. You won't believe the brother who's here. He is so well qualified to lead this conversation as our guest. Sister Asarta?
Abagani, Brother Kwojo.
Abagani.
We want to lead into the ancestral profile?
Yes.
Okay.
Unless you want to read, why don't you read the purpose, start with the purpose of Sankofa Council in the bylaw.
Okay. I can do that.
Okay.
The purpose of this, the Sankofa Council, is to use the African principles of unity and cooperation to create a healing environment for our community. And by, in one way, in bringing our current broadcast and discussion we have this evening, which I'm excited to move forward in.
Would we like to hear our ancestral profile?
All right, let's go into that. I'm excited to present our ancestral profile tonight is Melodoma Patrice Somay. He was a West African writer and workshop leader, primarily in the field of spirituality, ultimately being called a fireman, someone who comes to quench the fires of an urgent situation. This fireman, however, responded to an extraordinary call, for the fire he attended is consuming Western civilization itself. Melodoma, whose name translates roughly as "be friends with the stranger or enemy," was born January 30th, 1956, in the landlocked West African country of Burkina Faso, then known as the French colony of Upper Volta. Taken from his village by Jesuits at age 4 to be trained as a new generation of native missionaries, Melodoma was subjected to a harsh religious training and cultural indoctrination for the next 16 years. His native Dogara tongue literally beaten out of him and replaced with French and Latin. At age 20, he rebelled, punching out a priest and then escaping into the jungle to walk without food or money more than 100 miles back to the village of his birth. When Melodoma returned home, his mother was slow to recognize him, and he had difficulty communicating with his own people. Many villagers believe that literacy takes up the space in the mind where the spirit is supposed to reside, and therefore they regarded Melodoma as hopelessly contaminated by civilization, which they thought of as the wilderness. After a difficult year of adjustment for Melodoma, the elders decided he should be initiated into the tribe at 7 years past the usual age, even if it killed him. They believed the destiny represented by his name was of great importance and that it could not be completed unless Melodoma was initiated. As described in his autobiography of Water and the Spirit, Melodoma's initiation ritual was a 40-day ordeal of physical challenges, emotional and psychological surrender, and transcendental experience. Some of his story can be understood by Westerners as the stuff of dreams and visions. Some of it directly challenges our accustomed view of reality. Melodoma tells his story to remind readers of the purpose of indigenous initiation, to help young people recognize in themselves an inborn destiny and purpose, which they are to take up as they enter adulthood. The fact that Western culture recognizes no inborn destiny for its children and offers them no effective initiation into socially worthy purposes may explain much of the disaffection of our youth and such related problems as crime and violence. In Melodoma's case, initiation crystallized his destiny of befriending the stranger or enemy. Soon after that, his elders sent him forth from the village to live in the modern world. Their prediction was the village will be reborn in the heart and soul of the culture that is destroying the village. Melodoma was to teach village ways and wisdom to modern West. Resuming his academic education at the University of Burkina Faso, Melodoma eventually went on to earn 3 master's degrees and 2 doctorates, one in political science and one in literature from Brandeis University. Several years later, Melodoma was teaching African culture at Michigan University when he was informed by his elders that a comfortable university position was not what they had in mind for their cultural messenger. It was then that Melodoma began working with leaders within the men's movement, earning unceasing praise as a teacher of ritual and indigenous wisdom. Likewise, his book of Water and the Spirit has been praised by poet and art and novelist Alice Walker, who calls it a shimmering missing piece in the story of Earth, and by Jungarian analyst Marion Woodman, who finds it an unforgettable book. Once you experience his story, you cannot see your world ever again in the same way. Melodoma speaks of tribal and transcendental experience in down-to-earth Western terms that are nonetheless startling in their originality and urgency. In his autobiography, he wrote, "There's no doubt that at this time in history, Western civilization is suffering from a great sickness of the soul. The West progressive turning away from functioning spiritual values, its total disregard for the environment and the protection of natural resources, the violence of inner cities with their problems of poverty, drugs, and crime, spiraling unemployment and economic disarray, and growing intolerance towards people of color and the values of other cultures. All of these trends, if unchecked, will eventually bring about a terrible self-destruction. In other words, our house is on fire. It might be wise to consider the advice of this exceptional fireman. Maladoma Patrice Somme died this past December the 9th, 2021. May we give great thanks for the gift of his life as he rests in peace. Ashe. Thank you. Now I turn it back to you, Brother Charles, Brother Jorge.
Yes, yes. Anybody who hasn't read that book, read another book that brother wrote, Maladoma Somme, The Healing Wisdom of Africa. When I first heard about him, I was listening to the talk show on NPR, National Public Radio. I had to pull off to the side of the road. It was so deep. And then we found a way to bring him to Milwaukee. But when I was looking to find out how to contact him, and I noticed that he was booked all over the world. I mean, this brother, he's an African shaman. And on top of that, he's got two PhDs and advanced degrees from university, also in Europe, European university. So this brother he died too soon. He was only 66 years old. Now, one of the things that we are attempting to do as an organization, Sankofa, is to reclaim our legacy and our from our ancestors. And Maladoma Somme was one person who was able to do that. He was able to link his indigenous culture to our Western world. And he was able to heal people who had schizophrenia and all kinds of diseases that psychiatrists weren't able to do here, just using rituals from his indigenous culture. So now this is perfect time to introduce our guest, Brother Ted T. Marsh, who is president of Two Wind Communications from El Sobrante. You have to show me how to pronounce that, brother. California. I believe that's a suburb of Oakland. And Ted Marsh is a master coach to leaders at all levels faced with the challenges of evolutionary, revolutionary, and transformative change. A skilled facilitator, he is able to link critical strategic issues facing commercial and non-profit organizations, including cultural diversity, performance enhancement, and creative learning. Having served in a variety of executive positions, including CEO, he has been able to merge his technical marketing background with strategic planning and reshaping working cultures. After a successful corporate career in AT&T and Procter & Gamble, Mr. Marsh has elected to step up to the challenge of promoting the development of modern organic systems, drawing out the best of human attributes. Refining human systems is crucial to thriving during this period of turbulent change. This firm, Two Wind Communications, specializes in intensifying and expanding winning relationships in a thriving environment. A decorated Vietnam veteran, Mr. Marsh served as contract officer with Naval Construction Forces and Naval Facilities Engineering in Washington, D.C. He has served on the executive board of the International Computers and Communications World Leaders Council. He is a co-founder of the Northern California Black Employee Association and African American Human Resource Forum. He also served as a certified associate and senior counselor for Lee Heck Harrison, a national employment transition firm. More recently, he served as chief coach for CIE Institute, promoting innovative distance learning processes for Oklahoma State University. He authored several articles, which have appeared in trade journals and human resource newsletters. He has been interviewed and referenced for his expertise on cultural diversity by the San Francisco Chronicle and KGO-TV, and he continues to host public workshops on positioning yourself and your organization in chaotic change and self-empowerment for minority and women professionals in corporate America. Sharing his insights, he served as an executive mentor to high potential women executives through the Mentium 100 program, a co-founder and chief facilitator of the East Bay's Men's Support Group, Gathering of Black Men. He continues to select high potential males to facilitate their addressing the challenges of responsible manhood. He is compiling a comprehensive guide to his program, The Journey of Manhood. Previously, he served on the board of directors for the Mentoring Center and Equity Institute. And his formal education is he has an MBA from the University of Wisconsin, a Bachelor of Science from in Electrical Engineering from the University of Missouri-Rolla, and he has a postgraduate degree in Organizational Behavior from the University of Michigan. And his certifications are as Senior Counselor for the Lee Heck Harrison and CIE Integral Coaching New Ventures West San Francisco, Learn as Leadership Mastery, San Rafael. So with without taking any more time reading about how powerful this brother is, why don't we have him address our listening audience? Brother Ted Mark, are you there?
Well, thank you. Yeah, Brother Charles, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Oh, great, great, great. I was concerned. But it's good to be here. It's good to be here as part of this council and to discuss the topic of elderhood, which is near and dear to my heart. I'm extremely excited to speak to any audience as we move forward in terms of our progressive journey and taking ownership of our communities. And recognizing that if it's not us who takes responsibility and ownership of our communities, then we can expect others to continue to do what they're doing. And that's not in our self-interest. So I want to start off by just providing a little bit of background in terms of how I got involved in this conversation called elderhood. At the age of 50, I came to recognize that there was something missing. And I didn't know exactly what it was. Having gone through several transformational programs, I realized that when the heart and the spirit tells you that something is missing, continue to sit in that space and explore the question of what's not working, what's working, and then what's missing. And because of our Western education, most of us spend a lot of resources working on what's not working rather than focusing on the latter two, which is what is working and then possibly what may be missing. For instance, if my automobile is not working well, you know, I could ask the question in terms of, oh, I could say my automobile is broken. But it's not the automobile that's broken. It's got four wheels. It's got gasoline. It's got oil. It's got an engine. It's got all the moving parts, but perhaps they're not moving in synchrony with one another. And so I have to ask the question in terms of both. So what part of my automobile is working so that I could at least eliminate that from my focus? And as a troubleshooter, from my engineering training, as a troubleshooter, that's part of how I was able to focus in on what perhaps is not working was to eliminate those things that seem to be working well. And so this is a trend of thought that those of us in the STEM environment, science, technology, engineering, and math, and physics, I should add physics, you know, we have been trained to at least diagnose issues in a particular format. Now, it's only later that I came to realize that that Western format in terms of using the scientific method was incomplete. And for much of my adult life, I operate from a consciousness that said I could still be logical, rational, and linear, and that that would serve most of my interests. It was only until I was 40 years old that I become aware of the process that there are different paradigms of consciousness beyond a rational, logical, linear thinking. And so that's what brought me into this conversation in terms of, at the age of 50, I started examining the question of what's missing in my community, and I came to a conclusion that one of the things that was missing was elderhood. Now, it's not because I had done a lot of research and looked at different cultures. It was just something spiritually that showed up in an awakening one morning that says, oh, we're missing the wisdom of elderhood. And so at that point, I started to, on a journey that says, oh, so I'm going to now look at what elderhood is. I had no idea what it was at the time. I'm going to look at that as a question. And hopefully I'm going to begin a venture to prepare myself for elderhood. So that was at the age of 50, I started on this journey, and it has lasted 27 years. So I have given it a lot of thought, done a lot of research since then in terms of answering this question. What is elderhood? How is it important in terms of facing the issues and concerns that we have today? And what is it that we can do collectively as a community to reestablish this critical element called elderhood to serve our community? So that's just a little bit of background. That's how I began on the journey.
You grew up in Kansas, and you had an experience of a very wholesome community that had elderhood.
I grew up in a small part of Kansas, in Wyandotte County. For those of you who are familiar with Kansas City and Kansas City, Missouri, which are twin cities in essence, it's just that every time we use the term Kansas City, we're really making reference to Kansas City, Missouri. Right across the river, of course, is Kansas City, Kansas. So I grew up in the Quintero district of Wyandotte County, which was almost totally black. And as I had mentioned to others, the value and the benefit of growing up in the Quintero district was that all of my relatives that I could identify at the time, all of my relatives actually were neighbors. And so my mom was one of 14 children. And so I grew up in the presence of both sets of grandparents and 13 uncles and aunts, in addition to growing up in a household with both of my parents, mother and father. I had one sibling who was about 16 months younger than myself. And so with that kind of support in the small village that we were raised in, and I say a village only because our neighbors all knew one another, and I have come to realize, of course, that that's more of a rarity today than a commonality. In fact, the place where I live today, out in the suburban part of the San Francisco, Oakland area, is I know very few of my neighbors next door. We do not socialize as we did when I was living in a small community. So that's a key point in terms of understanding the value
of growing up in a village kind of geographical area. So I wanted to pause for a minute to establish that as a background. Now, in the year 2005, I had an opportunity to work a I attended a workshop here in the San Francisco area. It was an all-black weekend retreat. And one of the questions that I posed at that retreat was, are black Americans behaving in a civilized manner? And, of course, that was a question that stimulated a lot of thinking. Are we behaving as a people in a civilized manner? And, of course, the first response question I got back was, so how do you define a civilized people? And so I came up with a very brief and simple explanation that says, civilized people takes the best from the past, which ties into your Sankofa conversation. It updates best practices with new contributions, and I generally say that's my 2 cents or my 10 cents worth, and I pass it on to the next generation. And so as we look at that chain of progress from taking the best from the past, updating it and revising it and adding our 2 and 10 cents worth and passing it on to the next generation, the number of people that I asked back in 2005 concluded that, in essence, we as a people were not behaving as a civilized people. And the question, of course, stimulated more discussions. How is it that the first people on the planet who we could identify as being civilized, somehow operating in this country, the United States of America, which is deemed to be the most technically advanced and socially advanced country on the planet, how is it that African Americans in this country have lost their way in terms of actually promoting the basic principles of civilization? And so that's a key question for us to ponder. For me, I meditated on that question for a number of years, not only in terms of asking what happened and why did it happen, but also it opened up different branches of exploration, which I undertook since 2005. So I wanted to basically describe what a civilized man and woman, when I say man, I'm talking about manhood, what a civilized person does. And that's, first of all, they honor nature. And we live in a society today that has placed a great deal of emphasis on technology and culture, and in essence has dishonored nature. And we see evidence of that with each passing year. We also recognize that a civilized person learns from history, shares information, and takes ownership of their communities of interest. When we look at those particular basic principles, we recognize that the reason we do that in terms of creating and establishing sustainability is we have to prepare for the next 5, the next 50, or the next 100 generations. And that's what indigenous people around the world have done. And so there's a revitalization that we can go through in terms of reacquainting ourselves, our overall responsibility. So I wanted to pause for a minute because I wanted to establish at least the importance of recognizing what it means, not just to be a citizen of this country, but actually what it means to be a citizen of the planet.
Baba Marsh, before you go on, I would like to announce to our listeners that we need you to mute your phone. If it is not muted, please do so, because our sound system is very sensitive and it is picking up background noises. 510-435 510-435. You need to mute your phone. Thank you, Baba Mars.
Thank you. Now, is there a special code that, like star six, or that they can do to mute their phones?
There should be a mute button on their dial that tells them to do that.
Okay. I know on the current phones, we have a mute button on the face of my phone. But for those who don't have that mute button, I think if they hit star six, that might mute their phone.
Okay.
Okay. So moving forward, I wanted to get into this conversation around the importance of elderhood. So as I was writing the program, designing the program called The Journey of Manhood, I looked at the key five stages of development for Black men. And that is, of course, childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, mature adulthood, and this current one, which we are still in the process of refining, called elderhood. And I started out looking at it from a standpoint in terms of, again, those questions, what's working, what's not working, and what's missing. And of course, I recognized that what was working, of course, childhood was working very well. In fact, you know, many of our academic experts have identified that our young boys and our young women at the early stages of their life are actually exercising strong curiosity, and they have their learning cues already turned on. It's only when we begin to go to the public school system do we begin to move from actually learning to becoming conditioned and educated. And in fact, part of the mantra that I grew up with, of course, was to not only do I learn to work hard and be industrious, but to work hard, get good grades, so that I could get a good job and, of course, live a satisfactory life. So work hard, study hard, so I could get good grades and so I could get a good job. And what that meant, particularly from my blue-collar parents, was to get a good job working for a corporation. And so it's only later in my adult life did I realize that part of the flawness, part of the malady of that mantra was to go and work for somebody else and to enhance the economic wealth of somebody else rather than the economic interests of my own community. And once I became deconditioned and recognized that that was a flaw, I started to quickly make an adjustment. So I worked in corporate for about 10 years, and I spent about 4 years. I spent actually a total of 11 years in the Navy Reserve, which was very fruitful for me in terms of understanding how institutions actually operate, and working over 10 years in corporate America so I can understand how the corporate process and the institution of corporations actually continues to enslave Black people. Now, I make a reference to corporations today as a corporate plantation because I realize that many of the behaviors, many of the values, and many of the principles that existed when we had institutionalized slavery in the antebellum period actually are carried over today in a corporate environment. And I'm not saying a corporation is bad or good or whatever. I just understand that many of the principles and practices adopted by corporations is a merger of military principles, which is a hierarchical top-down kind of control, and also containment, which is, of course, what we experienced during institutionalized slavery. And so as I looked at those five stages of, I'm going back to the five stages, childhood, adolescence, which is predominantly is a transitional period into adulthood, young adulthood, mature adulthood, and elderhood,
as I looked at those five stages, I realized that, of course, in order for us to have a healthy community, we must have healthy functions at each one of those five stages. And that's when I started to uncover the flaw in our overall cultural system and how the cultural system, the white male supremacist system per se, actually is designed to promote the interests of the white power structure and not the interests of its citizenry. So I want to pause for a second because I'm covering a lot of ground very succinctly. And if there are any questions so far, I wanted to allow enough space for you to ask questions at this point.
Baba Marsh, we are preparing to go to our top of the hour, so I'm going to ask you to hold your points, and then we've got a few people who are, I think, waiting for a question or comment, but we're going to take this time to take us into the top of the hour, and then we'll return to address the points that you have. You're really presenting some very poignant points and valuable information for us, but we don't want to have to break you off during the time that you're going into that. So we will take the top of the hour.
Okay, so we're going to do that now.
Are you or is anyone you know suffering from the horrific effects of trauma? If so, the Little Book of Affirmations, Claim Your Narrative Over Trauma, can help you. This short ebook is a self-help tool to help you get started on the path of healing from the impacts of trauma. It is important to know that trauma is not an event. It is how your body responds to an event. School shootings, police shootings, the death of a loved one, car accident, all of these events can cause trauma in our bodies. But you can heal from it. I repeat, you can heal from it. So go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble to purchase your ebook today and just in time for the holidays, which is a time when a lot of people are suffering. Give the gift of healing for yourself or for someone you care about. The book was written by a licensed professional counselor who specializes in trauma-informed care. Follow her on Instagram at PLT_LPC and LinkedIn at Patricia Taylor. And I repeat, Instagram at PLT_LPC. And LinkedIn at Patricia Taylor.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. Open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today at 414-988-3079.
Listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee radio broadcast, where the host is Dr. Janine James, Sister Ifua Ma'at, Sister Osati Anti, Brother Kwasi Craft, and Brother Quojo Robinson. The Sankofa Council of Milwaukee Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank Network, and it broadcasts on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Contact them at Sankofa Council MKE at gmail.com. I repeat, Sankofa Council MKE at gmail.com.
Well, we are very happy to be back again, and we have our host today is Baba Quojo Robinson, and he's also here with our guest, and that is Baba Ted Marsh. And before we go into continuing our conversation, Mama Asante has a message for us, a sponsor message.
Yes, we want to recognize our sponsor, EDOC Advice. EDOC Advice is a website created to provide a place to get answers to your health and medical concerns. Are you wanting more options than you feel you're getting? Let EDOC Advice help you with your problem, to help you solve your problem. Go to their website and ask your question. Their experienced professionals will help you obtain the help you need and that makes sense for you. www.edocadvice.com. That's www.edocadvice.com. They don't replace your health professional or provide your care, but they can help you to become a better consumer so that you can get the best information to make a truly informed decision. They network with other professionals throughout the country and bring that information to you. EDOC Advice. Thank you.
Well, we're happy to have back Baba Quojo Robinson and Baba Ted Marsh.
Yes, Queen Mother, Dr. James, do we have some people who wanted to ask questions before we resume the second part of the discussion? Were you able
we
to
have listen? A call at 510-435-510-435. We'll come back. I see one also at 414-276. 414-276. How about 414-241? 414-241. So we have listeners. We're happy to have listeners. 241-241-414-241. We have 414-507. 414-507.
Okay, if you have questions, you want to take yourself off mute. Okay. I will continue, and if you have questions, I'll pause periodically and allow time for individuals to ask questions.
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
When you spoke of Black Americans behaving in a civilized manner, taking the best from the past and adding to pass forward to the future, what are we looking at as civilized?
Yeah, it was a general question that was posed to the group back in 2005. And once I gave that as a simple and brief definition, the 100% of the people that I had queried with that question answered the question with no, we're not behaving in a civilized manner. Now, that was a poll of about 200 people that I polled back in 2005. And so that created an alert because, again, most of us being raised and educated in this country have this belief that we as a people are very civilized. We're educated. Many of us have multiple degrees. And so how could we not be civilized? But civilization has to do with community rather than intellectual attainment.
Thank you.
And so people were answering that question primarily in terms of how are we behaving as a community, and the answer was coming up negative.
I think as Baba Koja was mentioning at the beginning, at the introduction, and he spoke about people being in nursing homes and basically tuning out, that they've reached a certain age, they've retired, and we no longer hear from them. And it sounds as though what you may be addressing to us, that this is not a time for us to remove ourselves because we continue to be part of the community, and we actually serve as part of the community's needed solutions.
Absolutely. And again, adopting what we have adopted in terms of Western ideas, in terms of our most productive years, of course, or our early adult years, and between the ages of 21 and 65, and then everything after 65 is we put on the shelf in terms of you're not able to produce as a worker anymore. And so your value declines very rapidly from age 50 on. And that's a shame because, of course, that violates the basic principles of nature. And what we have identified and what Baba Kwojo has identified is that at the point when we need that wisdom, and I'm underlining that word wisdom, when we need it the most is when we put it on the shelf. And so it's kind of like fine wine. It's like when the wine is most valuable is when it doesn't get drank. And we have created a parallel analogy in terms of our Black culture. We have adopted some of the worst practices of our Westernization and consider that to be normal. And I wanted to distinguish between what is natural, which is of nature, and that which is normal, which is cultural norms. And we talked a little bit earlier that we have to actually distinguish, even when we honor our ancestors and pray to the souls and spirits that are always with us, we have to distinguish that senior citizens don't automatically become elders, and elders do not automatically become ancestors. Professor Ampin, in one of the local colleges here, who makes
several tours to Africa and does original research in Kemet and Kush, have made a very point that all of my dead relatives are not necessarily ancestors. I cannot draw from all of my dead relatives and call them ancestors and see them as a source of inspiration and spirit. And so that was a real eye-opener, because in most of our circles and in churches, we make reference to our dead relatives as if all of them actually support us today, and Professor Ampin does not subscribe to that. And I'm still in the process of processing that myself. But I want to move forward in terms of understanding how elders are really crucial in this time and place, and the fact that we are not honoring and actually creating this stage, this honored stage of wisdom called elderhood, and how we're paying a high price for doing that. So I wanted to share just the basic mission of elderhood. The basic mission is to create a social platform for community development and enhancement through the founding of Ascension's Elders Group. This group will focus on establishing various infrastructures and processes essential to support the healthy growth of African American youth from infancy into and through responsible adulthood. And so when we look at that particular level of consciousness, that particular level of expertise, we recognize that that level of awareness, that level of experience, that level and scope of understanding our history and the journey to arrive at elderhood is very crucial in terms of planning the next stages of development. We cannot rely on our 20 and 30 year olds to do that. They do not have a sound context for shaping the future. And so this is what is crucial in terms of actually having a community of elders to do that strategic planning moving forward. Now, part of the background that actually gave rise to the importance of elders is, first of all, that contrary to what I experienced when I was growing up in the 50s, where the majority of black households were two-parent households, today what we're experiencing, of course, are single-parent, 70% or more of black households are single-parent households. And what we notice, of course, is that in those single-parent households, most of them are led and headed by black women. And so the modeling that I had growing up in a village where it was very present to me to be in the presence of very strong black role models is many of our young men do not have that benefit today. We also have seen the results of that reflected in a higher rate of young black male violence. And consequently, with the war on drugs, we have seen a higher incarceration rate, and we've seen a major downturn in our financial and economic status. At the same time, we have to recognize that from the public education system is that more of our young women are actually going to and graduating from college than young black men. And that creates an imbalance in our community, which has to be, it pays a high cost. And the metaphor that I compare that to, and I'm throwing this out here, is during World War II, the population in the United States was about 140 million. And at any given time, what we did was I think about 6 million of our male population was actually overseas serving in the military. And what that created in terms of an imbalance not only in the social structure here in the United States, but an imbalance in the workforce, it had very strong residual consequences. And that was only during a four-year war. And what we have experienced as a people, of course, is since the war on drugs began, is we've gone through the last 50 years with that kind of imbalance. When you, in essence, take almost 2 million black males out of our communities and incarcerate them or have them part of the correctional system, is it creates a major imbalance, not only because when you incarcerate a member of a family, you actually incarcerate the whole family. And we have not really examined and understood the ramifications of that, and that it's intentional, and we pay a high price for that. And so that gave rise, of course, to examining the what I have identified as the intersectionality of the white male power structure in terms of maintaining its status in our country and actually inhibiting the amount of rights and privileges as well as the power exercised by African Americans in this country. And what we're noticing today with the as a result not just of what happened on January 6th, but in essence what has happened since the election of Barack Obama, is there's a major, major white reaction to the fear that they have that they are actually losing power in the country. And now it's projected that between 2040 and 2045, white people will be a demographic minority in this country. And it is triggering a great deal of fear around the loss of rights, privileges, and of course, being able to control the legislation. So I will continue. What is missing is we do not own our neighborhoods. We do not grow as we used to grow in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and in the early 50s. We did not grow transformational leadership. And so historically, the Marcus Garveys, the Malcolm X's, the MLK Jr.'s that were products of those times, is we don't have an institutional way to early identify our strong transformational potential leaders and nurture them and develop them so that they can actually take on the responsibility to deal with the struggles that we're continuing to face today. We also are the product of a failed public education system, and I say failed in terms of our education system was not designed to enhance and promote learning as much as it was designed to promote and develop future workers. And so the term education actually is a misnomer in today's environment. And the education that I received going through an all black K through 12 education system is no longer available to us today. And we actually make recommendations to compensate for that in terms of recommending that some of our young people go to HBCU so that they can at least get the experience of being in a predominantly black environment and being taught significantly by black instructors. And this is the importance of having... Go ahead. Was there a question? Oh, okay, let me continue. So two of the things that elders can actually create from a structural standpoint is early identification of our most talented and gifted performers. And I'm not talking about entertainers. I'm talking about transformational leaders. And to create at least a developmental pathway where they get sponsored, they get the kind of resources they need in order to be able to take on the responsibilities later in life. And today we rely on the white power structure to do that early identification, to provide the resources, and also to direct the attention that they have in terms of how it can best be used to serve the white power interests. That does not address the needs of our community. So I wanted to just bring that out. So there are some key goals that we as elders have, and that is to, one, select and support a success model. And that success model requires us to look at various rites of passage that allows individuals to actually move from one level of consciousness, the consciousness of childhood, into the consciousness of adulthood, into the consciousness of mature adulthood, and then eventually into the consciousness of elderhood, in order to create this thing that we've identified as a healthy community. And without those particular rites of passage, and for the constituency, our youth, to understand that there is a structural process that they can follow, i.e. a map that they can actually follow in terms of how they can actually exercise this new definition of success, which I am highlighting, this new definition of success in terms of what does it mean to be a successful contributor in a healthy and supportive success model community. If we have that map that we can lay out for them, I believe very strongly that we can actually shift the behavior. Most of the young men that I work with and have worked with in the past are operating from a consciousness of doubt, a confusion, and not understanding exactly how they fit in to the social structure that has been overlaid on them. And in that doubt, confusion, is they don't know exactly which way to turn. And so, again, in the inquiries that I've made with young men, I ask them, so, you know, what is your game plan in terms of establishing a life goal? And many of them look back like deer in the headlights and wonder, what are you talking about? My goal is, once I get grown, is to get a good job and make some money. And of course, that doesn't necessarily serve the complete interests of the community. So with that incomplete vision of what's possible for them, without the kind of leadership and guidance to nurture our best and brightest, is we will continue to get the results that we're getting right now.
Wow, you said an awful lot there, Baba. And it sounds like you're suggesting that we could actually learn from our ancestors who have a legacy, that we could actually revisit a legacy of community, where inside of community we heal ourselves, we educate ourselves, we protect ourselves, we bond, we support each other. And without that community, we don't have access to what it takes fundamentally to thrive, to be successful and to thrive.
Which goes to the key points in terms of the principles of Kwanzaa, in terms of unity first. And how can you have unity when right now there's such a large gap in understanding between black males and black females? And how does that get passed in terms of that distrust and the conflict and the confusion and the adversarial relationships that are being nurtured in our dominant culture the adversarial relationship between black males and black females, which plays out, of course, in terms of perpetuating the very symptoms identified in the Willie Lynch syndrome. And so if we don't have a sense of unity and collective support between our black males and our black females, then we cannot ever aspire to have a healthy community. So what you have identified in that question is that it's important for us to actually take ownership of our future, because that's what a civilized people do. A civilized people takes ownership of their future. And we in this country have been reluctant in this past generation, and I take ownership of my generation. My ownership allowed the following ownership, which are the 45 to 50-year-olds, to actually go to sleep and not recognize the responsibility of development moving forward.
Taking ownership implies that there's some governing body that's providing leadership and direction for that community.
Yes.
And so given that I am over 70 years old, I consider myself an elder, and am I eligible to step into that leadership role to provide leadership for my fragmented community, or is there something else that needs to be done for me to be equipped and qualified to be an elder?
Yeah, in the studies that I've done, you have to be nurtured, sponsored, and instilled by a more senior person to be introduced and accepted into the community of elderhood. That you cannot automatically age into this thing, which is commonly, we use that term elder loosely, where there's actually no vetting, no instillment, no acceptance, no formal place in the structure, no formal place on the map, because you cannot age into elderhood, although you can certainly age into seniorhood. And so there's a distinction between retired individuals, there's and senior citizens, and this thing that we are now identifying as elders. And elders is a stage of achievement and recognition by the community at large. It is not automatically automatically placed on individuals of a certain age. And I wanted to make that distinction really clear. So I have designed and laid out a vetting process for candidates such as yourself, and individuals who are over 60 who aspire to actually become accepted as elders, that they have to go through an 18-month or two-year, a minimum 18-month and a maximum of a three-year vetting process, which includes various stages of training, various stages of operating under a more senior individual, and actually going through a series of practices that demonstrate the individual has the competence to serve as a community elder.
Wow. So you put together an elder training, leadership training program.
I call it an elder vetting process. It's not so much a training program as much as it is a preparation and vetting process.
Preparation and vetting process. Wow. And how long did you work on that? How long did it take you to develop that program?
Yeah, I worked in collaboration with two other Babas for over a two-year period. We met once a week on a Wednesday for a two-year period, and we actually designed that vetting process. We referenced both African tribal models
We also looked at other indigenous models that use and rely very much on rites of passage, and also who have a different reverence for tribal elders as part of their normal culture. And but it took us over 2 years to actually design the framework for that. And then took another 10 years of looking and testing part of the vetting process as we went through various stages of refinement.
So there, through your work, there's established elderhood in the country?
No.
Through your program?
No. We have established a framework for preparing and vetting an institutional level called elderhood. But we have not established a group of elders as yet. That's still a work in process. I am looking around the country for candidates who are willing and eager to go through that preparation and vetting process. Until then, some of my peers have actually gone through African vetting process and have attained actually the identification as being village elders and have come back to the United States with that kind of installment. But we have not yet been successful in establishing elderhood in our local urban community.
Are you willing to talk about what are the issues that are coming out of not being able to get one, to at least establish one?
Yeah, but that's a longer meeting.
Okay.
that is a longer meeting.
On this
right now I'm promoting the need and the value, and the intent is that my intent prior to the pandemic, the occurrence of this pandemic that has further isolated us, my intent was to bring groups together in an immersion setting so that we could actually work through, fine-tune, and create a collective but standard practice to have this institution that we're identifying, community elderhood, in lieu of the African term village elders, because of the application here in the United States.
And when we speak of elders, we are including men and women?
Definitely. We're including men and women. Our focus primarily has been on men, only because we are men. And the group who actually designed this are men. Now, I understand in talking with some of my colleagues that Brazil, the country of Brazil, for instance, has a 3-year vetting process for elder womanhood. And so there's some lessons that we could actually learn both from Brazil as well as African. And for most of your listeners, you know that Brazil has the second largest black population in the world behind Nigeria. And so many of the African practices, and because of the location, the proximity of Brazil to Africa, many of the practices, African practices, migrated over to Brazil in a lot more fluid manner than we have adopted those practices here in the United States. One, because we have suffered from the not invented here syndrome, and secondly, because we've been conditioned to view Africa as primitive. But some of the other countries obviously have not been conditioned and propagandized to believe that African is primitive. They understand that African actually is the seat of civilization. And there's so much for us to learn. And there's so much that we do not understand that has been hidden from the Western world through Western colonial practices that restricts our learning these key lessons of nature.
Yeah, that's why I appreciated Brother Maladoma Somme, because he was able to bridge that gap. He was able to bring that information to us, and now he's gone. You know, I was talking to Sister Shikara Ali, who is a member of the International Black Summit, as you are also a member, Baba Ted. And at the time, she was in charge of health and social services for the city of Trenton, New Jersey. And when I shared with her about our formulation of a Sankofa Council of Elders, she got very excited and said, we need to have one here in Trenton, too. We need to have a Sankofa Council. Well, Council of Elders. She didn't say Sankofa. Council of Elders. I believe there's a hunger in our major metropolitan areas for something like that, like an alternative to what we have right now. And you talked earlier about what's working, what's not working, and what's missing. And is this primarily what you were saying that's missing, this governance, this community taking responsibility and governing itself?
Yes, absolutely. And to understand that it's not very difficult for people to understand there's a whole lot of difference between owning something and renting something. For instance, I own my automobile, but on occasion when I travel, I have to rent a car. And so the relationship I have with my rental car, of course, is entirely different than the relationship I have with my own vehicle. And so I have a vested interest in terms of maintaining my own vehicle, making sure it gets washed, that the oil change, that it goes in for regular maintenance, and that it's able to serve me the way that I want it to serve me. Whereas my relationship with a rental car is like I just have a passing interest in terms of, one, you know, I make a reservation, I pick up the car, I may have it for a week or even 2 weeks, but I don't consider washing. I never consider washing the vehicle. I never consider putting air in the tire. I never consider changing the oil. I don't even watch the radiator temperature to see if the thing is overheating or not. And so there's some basic relationship issues that we as owners of our community invest in, and we pay attention to, and we monitor, which reflects the overall health of our community, that doesn't occur when our neighborhoods are owned by other people. And I'm not even speaking about, and this is what Dr. Janine brought up in terms of, you know, well, what role do our politicians play in this scenario? Our politicians are not owners. And I think it was Ice Cube who brought out the point that we've had over 7,000 elected politicians since World War II in this country. And we recognize that their allegiance is not necessarily to the African people. Their allegiance primarily are to the people who fund their campaigns. And based on my own personal history, I recognize in my family, I'm one of the few individuals that make consistent contributions to political campaigns. And I recognize I do that primarily because if they don't get a contribution from me, they're going to get contributions from people who oppose my interests. And those are the people that they're going to have and express loyalty to. And so it's very important. Every month, part of my income goes directly to fund black politicians.
We got some callers on the line, we know, and this conversation is too good for us to hog all by ourselves. Dr. Janine, you want to check in with some of the people who are listening in our listening audience?
Yes. We have 414-276. Do you have a question or comment for us? I see Queen Mother Shabaka has joined us. Queen Mother? There's some thoughts you must have.
I know Queen Mother got something to chime in with.
Queen Mother Shabaka. 414-364.
Remind them to take themselves off mute if they have a question.
510-435. We called you earlier. I think you were on mute. You can take your off of mute and we take your comment. And 414-276. 414-276. 414-241. 414-241.
Yeah, I do have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. There it is. Yeah, you know, thank you so much for today's discussion. I think it is very important for us as a community to acknowledge the importance of our elders and have them properly vetted. My question is, you know, this isn't new for our community. We've seen these issues and addressed them historically. We also seen a historical backlash in our stability, right? If we do develop this type of council and have it effectively used, you know, what do we do to prepare for that backlash and so that we can sustain something like this and for our community?
Okay, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it, because we recognize anything that's perceived by the dominant culture to be pro-black is considered and treated to be anti-white. And we have to understand that's the nature of the beast, that's the nature of the white dominant culture, and we have to anticipate that there's going to be pushback anytime black folks get together and say, hey, I want to take ownership. And so we have to take the lessons from the past when we look at the massacre in Tulsa, Greenwood, and we look at what occurred in Rosewood, Florida, and the other 23 communities during Red Summer, which was between 1916 and 1921, or I think it was 1923. We have to understand that the reactionary forces at play is monitoring, and anything that's deemed to be pro-black is going to be considered anti-white, and we have to expect and plan for that strategically. So there's a specific game plan in terms of how we actually respond and how do we actually minimize through communications that backlash that you've identified. And I don't want to go into specifics over the electronic waves.
I had a conversation with my son today, and he knows that I am working with the Sankofa group. He knows about the programs that we're doing of this same nature. And one of the points that he brought up, which I was somewhat stunned about, and he acknowledged that those of his generation have been struggling and making some mistakes. And I ask them when they know that they have people who can offer some advice, who've had some experience in these things, why don't they reach out? And I said that I communicate through the means that they seem to like to use, and I will text and I will email. And my son, to my surprise, said, we really need you to communicate with us almost daily. They won't just think about the role that we play, but if we are making the effort to communicate with them, how are you doing, how things are coming along, then that's where the conversation can get started. And I can remember my older relatives often saying, why aren't those young people doing this or that? And so we have an assumption, even as we're speaking today, that that we have a value, that people need to call on us. But I think that the point that my son raises, which is not maybe the best way I might think of using my time, but clearly we see examples of folks struggling. And on the one hand, when you're among your peers, you think you're a genius. You've got some great ideas. And when I'm looking for someone to reach out to me, I get a call after the fact, after you have engaged in a contract that is five times the cost that it normally is, and your car has been repossessed, now you are reaching out to help you pay for it and fix it. And I think that most of us who are seniors resent that. And so I would certainly, the point being, though, how are we going to make this happen, even within our communities, that we are seen as valuable, and people our youth, our younger generations are utilizing what we have to offer. Baba Marsh.
Yeah. So part of your, thank you for the example, by the way, because part of your example really unveils part of the dilemma. First of all, we make a very sincere effort to send our children to school. And for some of us, of course, we plant the seed that said, you will go to college. You don't even have a choice in that. You will go to college. You will get a college education. And it's imperative. We make it imperative. And so, like you, I think, or like the example that you share, is there was an expectation somehow, because I have this knowledge, because I have this competence, that I expected the youth to come to me. And it's like, yeah, but we didn't set their thinking up for that. We didn't establish a framework or a process for them to come to me. So therefore, the ownership paradigm requires me to go to them. And part of the recommendation that I make is, first of all, we have to go into the public schools and be part of the after-school program. And we also have to establish a Saturday morning a Pan-African classes. I was raised as a Roman Catholic, and I went to the public school, which meant that on Saturdays I had to go to catechism training in order to maintain my status in the Roman Catholic Church. So that was a Saturday morning remedial process in order to keep me connected to my religious faith. What I have experienced, particularly in the Caribbean and also in Britain, is there are Pan-African schools that are established, and parents actually require their students to go to these remedial classes, after-school programs, and Saturday morning programs to learn their history. And we don't have to go far, because here in the Bay Area, where I live, is Koreans. I've worked for a Korean company as a partner for a short period of time. And I saw the same thing as in terms of my Korean counterparts, is they had these after-school and Saturday morning programs in order to instill in their youth the strengths and the values of the Korean culture. Japanese do the same thing. We have Buddhist temples downtown here at Oakland, and outside of Chinatown, by the way, we have Buddhist temples established in order to make sure that that their youth are vetted and understand the culture. Every community that I've lived in, there's always a Jewish community center. We as Black Americans have to take ownership and recognize that the public school system is not going to provide the necessary information, the necessary practices, the necessary competence for us to be owners in our community. And that's one of the things that's missing. So the example that you shared, Dr. Janine, is really relevant and important. And unless we create those vehicles, either through our churches or other public vehicles, is we have no excuse. We have no one to blame but ourselves.
Sounds like you know something about Carter G. Woodson.
A little bit.
I say that in jest.
A little bit.
The miseducation of the Negro.
I asked.
Yeah, and let me just piggyback on that, if I may, Brother Charles, is the public education system was designed after the automobile mass production industry. And so what we have done is we have created an assembly line kind of process. And if you are familiar, or if you've ever worked in an automobile plant, you know that there's a standard format, there's a standard quality practice, and everybody is force-fitted. All those vehicles are force-fitted to adhere to that standard. Now, when we take human beings, as unique and as different as each one of us is, and we force-fit us to adhere to a particular standard, we recognize in terms of human beings, is my sharp edges are going to get cut off. My arms may be cut off. We don't come in the same sizes. We don't come with the same talent. We don't come with the same gifted attributes. And so, therefore, if I'm forced into a standard pattern called the public school system, K through 12, is that we're going to lose some of those valuable parts that are needed in our transformational leadership vision. So it doesn't make much sense to me that, yes, I think there's a foundational understanding. We need to learn, we need to read, we need to become writers, and we need obviously have some basic understanding of science. But we also need to nurture our artists, our poets. We need to nurture music. You know, at one time you were not considered to be civilized at all unless you had some kind of musical training. And where we are strongest as a people is being cut out of our personal development. Because they're cutting music and band out of the school system. They're cutting art out of the school system because they're saying it's too costly to have those extra curricular activities. And we're cutting our we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and we're doing it intentionally, which makes no sense at all to me.
It's time for us to end up now. Thankful for you being with us, Baba Ted. And, you know, I wish our listening audience could appreciate, you know, who's speaking here tonight. This is someone who actually was the top commander of a Navy ship. That's who's talking tonight. And you don't find too many black men who have, you know, been commanders of Navy ships. But, and thank you, our listening audience tonight. I thank you also, Sankofa Council, for the support of this program and for sharing your vision for unity and following the Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn and use those principles in our lives. We look forward to bringing you more programs that we hope you will enjoy. And be sure to visit our sponsor, www.edocadvice.com and the Finley Medical Clinic. So good night and stay safe. And Sankofa family, and to all of you, until next time, your host, Bob Quojo Robinson. Mama.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up? This is a
stupid
party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right on. What's up? Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today.
Picket lines,
sister,
and picket signs,
sister.
Don't punish me,
sister,
with brutality. So you can see,
sister.
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, oh,
right now.
Talk to me,
brother.
You can't see,
brother.